Hey, it's Molly Webster. I have a surprise for you. Next month, myself and producer Mona Medgaukar are going to do an AMA about our snail sex tape episode. You can ask us anything about snails and the behind the scenes of making an episode work. How long did it take us to make? How did we come up with the sound effects? Why are snails and slugs related? The AMA will be on April 16th, and in order to come, you have to be a member of the lab. So go to radiolab.org/join right now, sign up, use the code word snail to get a discount on your membership. And also, if you sign up now, you get a snail enamel pin. If you're already a member of the lab, come to the AMA. Thank you for listening. Can't wait to see you there, April 16th.
Wait, you're listening?
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
All right.
You're listening to Radiolab.
Radiolab.
From
WNYC.
And NPR.
All right.
Okay, so let's just do the open.
All right. Hey, I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
This is Radiolab.
And today we're going to be talking, well, let's do it this way.
Which way?
I was at the 92nd Street Y in New York City, gathering spot for cool people with new books. And that particular week
is Richard Dawkins.
Richard Dawkins.
They like him.
Mm-hmm.
Don't make it so easy for him.
I decided to begin.
This is a real problem for a lot of people.
By quoting him to him.
You write, I don't know if it's in this book or some other, "The total amount of suffering per year in the natural world is beyond all decent contemplation. During the minute it takes me to compose this sentence, thousands of animals are being eaten alive. Others are running for their lives, whimpering with fear. Others are slowly being devoured from within by rasping parasites. Thousands of all kinds are dying of starvation, thirst, disease. It must be so. If there's ever a time of plenty, this very fact will automatically lead to an increase in population until the natural state of starvation and misery is restored." Ooh.
Darwin was worried by the same thing. I mean, Darwin recognized the total horror of the suffering in nature. It was one of the things that actually made him lose his faith. But he also realized that it's not just a fact that it happens, it's intrinsic to natural selection that it must happen. And when you look at a beautiful animal like a cheetah that appears to be beautifully designed for something, like a cheetah is amazingly well designed apparently for catching gazelles, and gazelles are amazingly well designed for escaping from cheetahs, that they are the end products of a sort of evolutionary arms race in which thousands, millions of animals have died. The shaping, the carving of the shape of a cheetah or a gazelle has come about through millions of unsuccessful gazelles being caught and the successful ones making it through, only to be caught later probably, but after reproducing and passing on the genes that helped them to escape. So the sheer number of deaths that lie behind the sculpting of these beautiful creatures is horrifying, and at the same time, it's got a kind of savage beauty.
Wow. Why did you blame this exactly?
Well, because I was sitting there thinking, I know the cheetahs chase and eat antelopes, but wasn't there a nice cheetah once that went over to the antelope and said, "Hi, have a sandwich together," and that maybe something about the cheetah and had something to do with an act of kindness? I can't imagine.
So you're thinking that maybe it's not just meanness that can sculpt, but maybe niceness can sculpt too.
Exactly. Niceness as a scalpel.
Niceness as a scalpel? Ooh. I want to listen to that show.
All right.
Wait a second, we are that show. We should do it then. Let's do it. Today on Radiolab. Goodness.
Kindness.
Selflessness.
Altruism.
If the world is so cruel, how do you account for it?
Yeah.
How should we think about it?
And when you do see generosity, how do you know it's really generous?
All right, so we're going to start the show with a story that sort of embodies the last question you asked about a guy named George Price, who is a mathematician we never heard of until our producer, Lynn Levy, told us about him. She heard about it from an author, Orrin Harman, who wrote a book called The Price, as in George Price, of altruism.
Check it out. You know, this is a high school photo.
So, okay, so the people on the radio can't see the picture. So describe what he looks like.
Well, I tell you, he looks a bit like sort of some kind of Scandinavian prince in the 17th century. Good-looking guy.
Totally. Definitely something about this guy's eyes.
His eyes.
Yeah.
This was described to me by a number of people who knew him. He had a gaze that you sort of walked away from at your own peril. There was something that, you know, he sort of knew things.
You could start George's story anywhere, but let's start in 1943.
Okay.
George graduates from college, and he's this
very kinetic kind of guy.
Really athletic.
He'd swim in the surf, and he did a lot of rock climbing.
And by all accounts, he was
incredibly brilliant.
And right after college, he starts to kind of bounce through history.
He was all over the place.
First place he ends up is
the Manhattan Project on uranium enrichment. So he was working as a chemist on the atom bomb. When he was done with that,
after a couple of years,
he made a 90-degree turn and started working at Bell Labs on transistor research. Solved some very basic problems there and then disappeared like a phantom. Started working at a medical center on oncology research.
Meaning cancer.
And I remember going to his lab, playing hide and seek, all these bottles and test tubes.
By this time, George had a wife and two kids.
You look under the microscope at slides of blood.
Anna and Kathleen. But he never really saw them that much.
He'd work 56 hours straight without sleeping on Benzedrine.
And I remember he was always
stuff like that.
Gone a lot.
Mm. When the kids were still pretty young.
We were like 5 and 6.
He
left his family.
Yeah.
Just left.
Turned another 90-degree corner and began working on computer-aided design. In fact, he invented computer-aided design. He was firing in all directions.
What do you think was driving him to keep moving from thing to thing?
He just wanted to succeed at any cost. It made no difference in what field. And at one point in time, he was corresponding with about 5 Nobel laureates, each in a different field. He wanted to have one great discovery that would make his name.
So that's George.
Wow. Quite a guy.
Very interesting guy.
So what happens next?
So next, what happens is he gets on a boat and he goes to London.
When was this, by the way?
It's November 1967. Yeah. And in London, that's where things, for our purposes, start to really happen.
Boy, what happens in London?
Well, he starts looking for this question. He goes from library to library. There are 13 libraries that he would hang out at. And the question that he finds for himself, which is weird considering his personal history, is...
Why family?
Like, why do people have families?
Well, like, why do families stick together?
There are a lot of sort of dynamics within the family where it would make more sense for an individual to sort of break out.
You know, go it alone. Like he had.
And yet, family persists. And there should be a good reason for it.
He even wrote about the question to his daughter.
Dear Kathleen, my big paper will be on the evolutionary origin of the human family. In most species, the father just mates with the mother and she does all the child rearing herself. But in the human species, the dominant pattern has involved care by adult males toward their own children. Why did our species evolve this way? You know, it just brings back what kind of a father our father was towards us. And basically, there was kind of this benign neglect.
Hmm. But this question, why family, was only the beginning. Why family led him to a bigger question, which is, why does anybody help anybody?
Huh. Well, what do you mean?
If you think about Darwin's idea, survival of the fittest,
mm-hmm.
think about what that really means. It means if you are a creature, you have 2 big, important jobs.
You got to survive and you got to be fit.
Right.
Whatever that means.
Fitness really means how many babies can you make? How many babies are you making? And so if you do some stupid, you know, harebrained thing, that means you can't stay alive and or you can't make babies. That doesn't make any sense.
Right.
And yet, wherever you look in nature,
You see creatures doing this.
From bacteria.
To insects.
Birds. Bees, ants, and wasps. Fish. I'll give you an example. There's a species of amoeba called Discotelium discoideum, which usually the amoeba sort of lives on its own. It's a single-celled organism in the forest. Mm-hmm. But when resources are low, what it does is it sends out this chemical signal. And all the other amoeba, who are also single-celled,
they start sending out signals.
And they start sort of crawling until they all meet and they become one slug, which is now a single organism.
And this slug begins to sort of move along until it finds a place that's windy and sunny, at which point
it stops. And the top 20% of the slug, the top 20% amoeba in the head of the slug, begin to create out of their own body a stalk. Which hardens. And they die while doing so. But the stalk allows the bottom 80% to climb up the stalk and to create an orb at the top of the stalk.
And from there, all the amoeba that aren't, you know, dead, they can catch a wind.
To better pastures.
It's like a dandelion.
So what's happened is that the top 20% have really sacrificed themselves for the back 80%. And that's an amoeba. So you figure, what the hell is happening here? This was a great mystery to Darwin, and Darwin said, this is in fact the greatest mystery and the greatest riddle, and if I can't answer it, then my theory isn't worth anything.
And for 100 years, when people talked about evolution, this thing, altruism, was the elephant in the room.
Should we just jump in? So we were curious about this.
Sorry, I'm...
How might you take this elephant, this niceness thing that seems to be everywhere, and shove it back into the mean old theory of evolution? There's got to be a way. And so we called up Carl Zimmer, who's a journalist we have on the show quite often, who writes a lot about evolution. And he told us that in the 1960s, just as George Price was starting to ask these questions, some scientists came up with a new way of thinking about altruism, a thought experiment, which he ran us through.
Okay, so Robert,
yeah.
Do you have siblings?
I have a sister.
Okay, you have a sister.
Sarah.
Okay, let's just imagine that. You guys are like home from college, say.
Okay.
And there's a flood at the Crulwich Manor. And the water's flooding around and you can see that your sister is about to die. If you save your sister's life and you die in the process, your genes, Robert Crulwich's genes, are gone.
Yep.
Right. This is the problem.
Yes. But you and your sister have the same parents.
Yes.
Okay. So your sister has 50% of your genes.
So if I rescue her, then half my genes survive?
Right. 50% move on.
Ah.
Now, if you had a sister and a brother, and you saved them both, they'd each have 50%.
So it's a wash.
And so it's effectively, it's like saving Robert Crulwich in his entirety.
Mathematically speaking.
Mathematically speaking, right.
Can you do this with cousins?
Yeah, actually. If you step it back to cousins.
What percentage? That's a quarter in the case of the first cousins? That is.
It's an eighth.
So
I have to have
eight cousins.
First cousins to equal my full genome.
Right. Yeah.
Do you have that many?
I have 32 third cousins, and that's why I always round them up at a rodeo every year.
And you place them all together.
You guys stay here in case something happens to me.
But here's what I don't get. Like, how does this actually operate? Like, Robert's not going to sit there while the manor is flooding and be like, well, let's see. I have a cousin that's an eighth and a second cousin that's a 32nd.
No, so you understand. The math has already been done. The math has been done by evolution on genes. And those are the genes you got.
Oh, so you're saying that that evolution has turned the math into an instinct.
Yeah, you got it.
I don't think I get it. Like, so what is the instinct here? I know I want to save my sister.
Yeah, well, so here's how I understand it. Since sis has half your genes,
yeah,
and since second cousin only has a 32nd, yeah, theoretically, your instinct to save your sis should be 16 times stronger than your instinct to save.
No, that's actually roughly proportionally correct.
Really? But keep in mind, this was just an idea. It's just a thought experiment. Until our guy, George Price, comes along and writes an equation which shows mathematically how an instinct like this could evolve.
It's very powerful. Okay, so... Well, do you want me to just read the letters?
Yeah.
What is the equation? What equals what?
Okay.
Okay, so it's
W times delta Z
equals the covariance
of W I comma Z I
plus
E.
We call it E.
W I delta Z I.
Oh, of course.
Yeah.
There you go.
So complicated. I mean, it was simple a second ago.
No, it sounds a little complicated. He's not just dealing with like a simple setup. It's like he's got the traits and how they affect the different groups and how things change over time. So it's a big, there's a lot going on in there.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Do you understand what you just said?
Not,
So here, this is a really interesting letter. Which should read.
When he did write the equation, he walked off the street into the university.
University of London.
In London, complete unknown. Had just moved from America. No one knew who he was.
I went to talk to a Professor Smith.
And he showed the equation to the professor and said, "Is this new?"
I felt sure that someone must have discovered it before.
The professor looked at it, and after a very, very short amount of minutes, gave him an honorary professorship and the keys to an office. One of the best genetics departments in the world.
So George is sitting in his office, which, by the way, is on the site of Darwin's old house.
Whoa.
Yeah. And he's made this big discovery, and he's thinking. Thinking. Thinking.
Thinking philosophically about what it all meant.
Thinking. Thinking.
If I can write a formal mathematical treatment of the evolution of a trait like altruism, what it means about the trait is that the trait is never really purely altruistic.
If making a sacrifice helps me in the end, or helps my genes,
sort of like selfishness in disguise.
Yeah.
If that's true, the world is a terrible place. Because it means that there's no true, there could never be true selflessness in the world. My math means that there cannot ever be true selflessness. And I can't accept a world like that.
Why could he suddenly not accept a world like that?
I don't know. Oren thinks it might be because...
Precisely because he had been so selfish for most of his life. And so he decided in his own life to embark on a program of radical altruism that would prove that there was true selflessness in this world. And that's what led him to the streets of London, in search of homeless people, derelicts, down and outs. And he began by sort of just walking up to them, introducing himself. "Hello, my name is George. What's your name? How can I help you?"
To random people on the street?
Yeah.
"Everywhere I go, I keep running into down and out alcoholics, to whom I give when I have anything and with whom I sit and drink from their bottle if they offer me a drink."
He'd buy people sandwiches or give them a few pounds.
"Whether it's by giving them money, cleaning a filthy kitchen..."
And then it got bigger.
He started giving out keys to his place.
Inviting these guys into his home.
People were coming and going. He was giving them food, clothes. And after a few months of charity like that, he was out of money.
There was one letter that he had written to John Maynard Smith, another great biologist of the era, which said, "John, I'm down to my last 15p, and I can't wait to get rid of the last 15.
Huh.
He thought he was proving his equation wrong.
So by getting poorer and poorer and giving away all this stuff, he was somehow negating the thing his math seemed to say was inevitable, the selfish instinct?
Yeah. You know, he had this self-preservation instinct, and he was going to fight the self-preservation instinct, and he was going
to
win.
To sort of beat the mathematics that he himself had written.
So he was approaching it almost like a math proof.
Yeah.
"Here we go. Is this the red one that you'll be talking into?"
When he ran out of money, George moved out of his apartment and into this abandoned house in a part of London called Tolmer's Square.
"Which one does the volume for my headphones?"
Which is where he met Sylvia.
"It was rough. There were just poles holding the walls up. Some places had walls."
She was a young artist, also squatting at the time.
"And the buildings are crumbling, you know. People had made makeshift staircases."
And George had, like, a room?
"Well, a few clothes on the floor, not much. But, you know, you could see he was always thinking. He would go around asking other people, 'Does anybody have shoes they don't want? So-and-so needs a pair of shoes.' You know, that would be part of it. But it might also be like if somebody was sick, getting him to a doctor. Because if you were homeless, it's very hard to have a doctor. But like you say, all this is going on at the same time. He was getting thinner and thinner. His thin little neck and these clothes that just hung around him.
Hmm. He began writing letters to his daughters.
Apologizing, weeping.
Dear Henry, sorry I deserted you like that, and I'm sorry I was such a poor father to you.
Yeah, I've been a terrible father.
Looking at your picture now makes me wish I could do it all over again.
Maybe where I come into the picture is he wanted to begin again.
She says George asked her to marry him over and over.
At first I thought it was kind of a joke, and I was saying, George, we can't get married, you know.
She said no each time, and at a certain point, he gave up.
It's hard to really, really remember, but it was colder. As the winter came on, you wouldn't see George as often. He became quieter, I think. I just remember I'm quieter.
One morning, this guy that was sharing a squat with George,
name is Shmuli Katia,
he was heading out the door.
He found beneath the door, as he was going out of the building, he found beneath the door a letter. And since they were living in a squat, he was afraid that this was some kind of eviction notice or something like that. And he didn't read English. He couldn't read English. So he ran up the stairs and knocked on George's door, because George was the only one who could read English. And when he knocked, the door sort of kind of went in a bit, and he could see in the aperture that there was blood all over the linoleum floor. When he had enough of an opening, he could see that George was sitting there with no blood left in his body.
He killed himself?
Yeah.
He took a pair of scissors and cut through his carotid artery, which is a very, very sort of terrible death. Poor George.
Thanks to producer Lynn Levy. For more on George Price, be sure to read Oren Harman's book, The Price of Altruism. And thanks also to Carl Zimmer. His latest is Microcosm.
We'll be right back.
Hi, this is Anne-Marie Price.
This is Kathleen Price. Radio Lab is funded in part by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation,
enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
More information about Sloan at www.sloan.org.
This is Oren calling. Radio Lab is produced by WNYC
and distributed by NPR. This is Carl Zimmer. Bye.
This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Guys, it's tax season. Are you as stoked as I am? No, no, of course you aren't, because taxes can be super stressful. I know that I'm going to owe money, and so I'm avoiding all the emails from my accountant. I'm not alone. 88% of Americans reported financial stress at the start of 2026. So it's normal, but it doesn't mean you have to white-knuckle your way through. When life feels overwhelming, therapy can help. BetterHelp makes it easy, it says, by matching you with one of their over 30,000 licensed professionals tailored to your needs. And if it's not a perfect fit, you can switch at any time. And look, a therapist can't fix your money problems, but they can help you address shame, guilt, avoidance. Get matched with a qualified professional on BetterHelp. You can sign up and get 10% off at betterhelp.com/radiolab. That's betterhelp.com/radiolab.
You know, every day on Up First, NPR's Golden Globe nominated morning news podcast, we bring you three essential stories. At the heart of each story are questions. What really happened? What really mattered? What happens next? At NPR, we stand for your right to be curious and to follow the facts. Follow Up First wherever you get your podcasts and start your day knowing what matters and why.
Hey, this is Radiolab. I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
Our topic today is?
Goodness.
Goodness, selflessness.
So we've done the math. The math leaves me a little on the cold side.
Wonder why. So you know what? Forget the math. Forget it.
Let's go to the people who do the deeds.
Yeah, people who do amazingly brave and heroic things.
Yeah.
No math required.
And maybe find out, I don't know.
What makes them different than the rest of us?
Yeah.
that question led us?
Walter Rutkowski.
To a guy named Walter Rutkowski.
And I'm the executive director and secretary of the Carnegie Hero Fund Commission.
Cool. Well, thanks for doing this.
Okay.
Can you just give us a little background on the Hero Fund? What is the Carnegie Hero Fund?
The Carnegie Hero Fund is a private operating foundation that was established by Andrew Carnegie in 1904. And what we do is recognize civilian heroism throughout the United States and Canada by giving an award called the Carnegie Medal. And accompanying the Carnegie Medal is a financial grant.
How much?
Currently, the amount is $5,000.
Wow. And how do you guys choose your heroes?
We judge the heroic acts against a list of requirements.
So then you have to have some kind of definition of hero, which includes some and excludes others.
Yes.
Perfect.
A basic definition, which is a civilian.
One.
Meaning no military, who voluntarily.
Two.
Leaves a point of safety.
Three.
To risk his own life or her own life.
Four.
To an extraordinary degree.
Five.
To save or to attempt to save the life of another human.
Six. And how about seven? Why?
Can you read that one more time?
Okay, I wasn't reading. That just came from memory. So the
Like, what is it that happens in a person's mind at that pivotal moment when they decide to voluntarily
leave a point of safety
and risk their life to an extraordinary degree
to save the life of another human?
That's what we wanted to know. Should we just jump in?
Okay.
So the first one we have on our list is Laura Schrake.
Okay. That's file number 73546, and the award number is 8005.
I am Laura Schrake. I'm from Mattoon, Illinois, and I currently live in Dubai, United Arab Emirates.
Oh, wow.
Laura spoke with our producer, Tim Howard.
Okay, so we're going back a little bit here.
Yeah, 15 years.
Back in the mid-90s.
1995.
I was a 21-year-old college student.
And I was driving through the country, and I saw a woman getting mauled by a bull in a pasture.
So she stopped to see what was going on.
Jumped out and started yelling at her to see what I could do. The woman was on the ground and the bull was
950-pound Jersey bull.
Tossing her in the air and back on the ground.
Wow.
She was clearly struggling.
And where were you?
I was right on the other side of the fence, but the fence was electric.
So here's the moment that we find fascinating. At this point, Laura can either go forward through thousands of volts of electricity toward an angry bull that will likely maul her too, or she can stay safe.
I went ahead and just climbed through the fence. And I don't remember ever feeling the electricity.
She says by the time she got through,
crazily enough,
a neighbor had shown up and threw her a piece of pipe.
Maybe about 2 feet long.
So she approached the woman,
who was still conscious. The whole time she's yelling at me, hit the bull in the face as hard as you can and don't stop.
So Miss Shrake went up to the bull and beat it repeatedly with this 2 foot length of tubing.
I think it distracted the bull enough where she was able to get out from under him. And as soon as we were outside the fence, looking back into the pasture, the bull was literally right there at the fence.
Kicked the ground a few times and snorted.
He was not happy.
To our question.
When you were there at that fence,
mm-hmm.
and you had the choice to either stay put or to go through it, what was going through your mind? Was there a calculation there?
No, I can't really say that. I mean,
you didn't weigh your options or anything like that?
I did not, no. It was just, here's the problem, here's what I need to do, and something needed to happen.
Huh. So there's no choice moment?
Not that I recall. No. If nobody came to this woman's rescue, she would die.
Unfortunately, this is the usual explanation, says Walter. No explanation.
I couldn't stand there and not do anything. I was compelled to act.
I didn't really take the time to think about what else could happen.
No, I can't say I ever really thought about my own life at that time.
Okay, we just jumped ahead because we thought we'd try again. That's the voice of the next Carnegie hero that Walter told us about.
Yeah, William David Pennell.
Name's William Pennell.
Who is the 8,362nd person to receive the Carnegie Medal.
Our producer, Lynn Levy, tracked him down.
Bill, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
William David Pennell was 37 years old at the time of his heroic act.
Was it 1999?
Yes, it was early in the morning. It was like
3:19 a.m. in a small town near Pittsburgh.
Vicksburg, Pennsylvania.
Monongahela, Pennsylvania.
We was in bed sleeping, and my wife heard a loud crash. I actually didn't hear it. And a dog, my one dog was carrying on. So right away, I run down there.
Mr. Pennell went outside his house. There was a very bad automobile accident. A car crashed head-on into a utility pole.
Flames was like rippling up the windshield out from under the hood.
And he responded to the scene wearing only sweatpants.
No shoes or shirt or nothing on it.
Bare-chested and barefoot.
So here we are. Bill's standing in front of this ball of fire. There are three drunk teenagers inside that car, though he doesn't know it. He can either A, do nothing, or B, go in
through the driver's door.
And this big fella slumped out the door, so I reached in and grabbed a hold of him.
Around the chest, pulled him from the driver's seat out to the ground.
Meantime, the car was just like blazing. And my neighbor was there. She was hollering, there's more of them in there. So I run back to the vehicle.
Found that the front seat passenger was trapped in the wreckage.
I finally got him loose and pulled him out.
Apparently, Mr. Pennell was aware that a third person was in the car, a third young man. Mr. Pennell entered the car a third time. By then,
there was tires blowing out.
Flames had grown to about 3 feet above the car's roof.
The interior, like the headliner of the car and stuff, was dripping like plastic down on my back. I mean, I'm in there screaming, you know, somebody give me a hand in here. But nobody would help. And I reached in and grabbed a hold of the kid that was in the back by the scruff of the neck and pulled him out.
All right, so when you were coming out of your house and you're looking at that car, what was going through your head?
Just trying to help. I mean, I did what any normal person would do. I mean, you know, I just kept saying, this is somebody's kid, you know what I mean? At the time, my daughter was like 16, and I'm saying to myself, you know, if something, God forbid, would ever happen to her, that I would hope someone would be there to help.
Did you ever talk to your neighbors and ask them why they didn't come in there?
You know what? That's it's funny you brought that up, because no, I've never brought it up. Never brought it up.
How come?
I don't know. I guess maybe I probably wouldn't like their answer. I don't know. I don't know why I've never asked them out.
What do you think is the difference between you and those other people who just sort of stood by?
I couldn't answer that. I couldn't answer that.
So our bull girl, she didn't know. This guy didn't really know either. Somebody must be able to tell us something about what they were thinking at that moment that allowed them, that gave them the courage to do what they did.
I can't give you a definite answer as to what propels people to do this, no.
But we took one more shot with Walter, and he told us about a case that of all the cases he's heard, this is the one that puzzles him the most.
It's the case of Wesley James Autry, a construction worker from New York, 50-year-old man, who did jump into the track bed in a subway station to remove a young man who had fallen onto the track. The gentleman was 6 foot, 180 pounds. He was inert, and yet Mr. Autry persisted despite the fact that a train was coming. There would come a point, at least in my estimation, where you would have to say, I have to get out of here because I'm going to be killed. I'm not suicidal. But Mr. Autry didn't think that way. He and I part in this manner. What he did was he lay atop the victim between the rails while the train passed over them. In the farthest reaches of my imagination, I can see myself jumping onto a subway track to attempt the rescue. What I can't see myself doing is lying atop the victim while the train passes over me.
Making this story even more nuts? When we finally met up with Wesley Autry on the platform where this incident happened, 135th and Broadway, he explained to us that his daughters had been with him.
They was okay. And
how old were your daughters?
At that time, my daughter was 4 and 6, and this them there.
Showed us picture.
Oh, my God.
Super cute.
The one behind me is Shuki, and this is the baby, Sashi.
So when they're standing there, and this guy starts convulsing and then eventually falls off the platform onto the tracks right as a train is coming, his choice is pretty stark. In order to save this complete stranger, he's got to leave his daughters behind. potentially without a dad.
I'm looking at him shaking and going into another seizure. For some strange reason, a voice out of nowhere said, don't worry about your own, don't worry about your daughter's. You can do this.
So he jumps, runs to the guy.
Is he conscious?
No.
Tries to grab the guy's hand.
And each time I grab this hand, we'll slip apart. And when he slip, I look up, the train is getting closer. I grab his hand again, we'll slip apart. The train is closer.
50 feet, 20 feet, 10 feet, and then it's right there. And all he can do is grab the guy, get him in a bear hug, and flatten his body against the guy as much as he can.
The first train car just grazed my cats.
Oh my God. Train car went right over
and
them.
And when the train came to a stop, 4 to 5 cars passed over us. I looked them in the eye. I said, excuse me, you seem to have a seizure or something. I don't know you. You don't know me. So I just kept talking to him until he came through. And he was like, well, where are we? I'm like, we're underneath a train. He said, well, who are you? I said, I came down to save your life. So he kept asking me, are we dead? Are we in heaven? I gave him a slight pinch on his arm. He's like, ouch. I said, see, you're very much alive.
Wow. Did you ever ask yourself at this point, like, what am I doing here? Well, I mean, he asked it, what am I doing here?
Well,
but what about
I can
you?
I can hear the two ladies who had my daughter standing in between their legs. I can hear my daughter screaming. So when that train come to a stop, I yelled up from underneath the train, excuse me, I'm the father, we're okay. I just want to let my daughters know that I'm okay because I know that they are worried about me. Everybody started clapping.
Can I ask you a question? So the point at which you said you heard a voice,
yes,
that said, I can do this.
I can do this.
What is amazing to me is that you left your daughters right here and dive after a guy you don't know.
He was a stranger, total stranger, but you know what? The mission wasn't completed. I was chose for that.
You felt chosen? Like you
felt
were
chosen. I felt like I was the chosen one.
Wow.
But for a religious person, though, I would wonder, why me?
Well, you know what? Maybe 20 years ago, I was supposed to be at a certain point.
And then he explained to us exactly why he had jumped. He was the one guy who could. He said right before his feet left the platform, this one specific moment from his life flashed to mind.
This thing that happened, you know, I had a gun pulled to my temple, but, you know, it was a misfire. So, you know.
A gun was put to your head and missed. So you were almost dead for a second or two.
I was almost dead. You know,
so you think you might have been spared for a purpose?
I was spared for a reason.
After that moment, he says, when the gun went click and he didn't die, he always wondered, why had God spared him that moment? Until he was on the platform and he saw the guy fall off. He says then he knew, this is why.
I can do this.
He was just, I can do this.
I can do this. That voice, when that voice said that you're going to be okay, I knew everything was going to work out.
You know what I think at the end of the day?
What's that?
I don't think that there's an answer to the question we asked. I don't think...
The hero question?
Why were you a hero? I don't think that any three of these heroes... I mean, the last one had the longest explanation. He had been selected for some purpose, but does he know why he was chosen? Not a clue.
Guy number three gives me something.
What does he give you?
Okay, so the first two, right? Yeah. They have no idea.
None.
So there's just something in them that made them act. But guy number three... He's talking about circumstances. Mm. Like the world prepared him for that moment. Mm. Serendipity. So it makes me think, well, what if circumstances are just right? Maybe any of us could do that.
I get a mailman. He used to say to me all the time, he says, how did you manage to do that up there? How did you manage to pull them kids out? I don't know if I could have done that. I said, well, you know what? Don't say you wouldn't do this or you wouldn't do that till you're put in that situation.
In fact, when we asked Walter, how many nominations do you get a year? Are they hard to find?
No, they are not hard at all to find. We are fortunate to be living in a society, regardless of what you hear elsewhere, we are fortunate to be living in a society where people do look out for others, even strangers.
He told us they've even had to up their guidelines to make it harder to win.
Simply because of the vast number of heroic deeds that happen in day-to-day life.
Hi there, this is Pedro Suarez calling from London, England. Radiolab is supported in part by the National Science Foundation and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. More information about Sloan at www.sloan.org. Oh, that's a bit of a tongue twister.
Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth's monthly prayer meetings infuse worship with the furor of Christian nationalism.
Let every round find its mark and let justice be executed swiftly and without remorse. Overwhelming violence of action against those who deserve no mercy.
He's taken all these verses about violence out of context and thrown them all together.
Inside Hegseth's holy war on this week's On the Media from WNYC. Find On the Media wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, this is Radiolab. I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich. Oh,
yes. Yes. Would you like to say our topic, Robert?
Our topic today is goodness.
Niceness.
Or altruism, or another bigger, fatter word.
Yep. And thus far, we've met a couple of folks, individuals who have struggled with altruism in some way.
Now we're going to sort of pull back and go from specifics to grand global
strategy.
Yes.
Hello.
Hello, hello. And we're going to tell you a really cool story, we think. It begins with this guy.
My name is Robert Axelrod. I'm the Walgreen Professor for the Study of Human Understanding in the Department of Political Science and the Ford School of Public Policy of the University of Michigan. Wow. I know that's a mouthful.
That was like your dean was like looking over you and said, say it all, please, say it
yeah,
all.
Yeah, well, you know, you could just say I'm a professor of public policy and political science or something.
Well, but before he was all of that, Axelrod, when he was in high school, he was one of those guys who just loved computers.
Well, yes. In 59, 1960, I hung around the Northwestern University Computer Center.
59, 60. So what, were those large pieces of furniture in refrigerated buildings?
They were. In fact, the whole campus had one computer, and they let me use it for 15 minutes here and 15 minutes there.
And what would you do with the computer?
What I did, a very simple computer simulation of hypothetical life forms and environments for a science project.
Ah,
really?
Yeah.
You're a pre-geek is what you are.
Yes.
Before the word had been invented.
I think you could say that.
But then in 1962... when Axelrod was down in a computer basement, I guess, somewhere, all over the world, everybody else was watching one of the great dramas in modern times.
Good evening, my fellow citizens.
Unfold.
The Cuban Missile Crisis.
Within the past week, unmistakable evidence has established the fact that a series of offensive missile sites is now in preparation on that imprisoned island.
And Axelrod started thinking about the dilemma we were in.
Well, each side wants to spend more money buying missiles and things.
You know, we could build more bombs, but then they could build more bombs. It would be better if they would both stop, but if we stop and they don't...
that would be bad.
Very bad.
Yeah, and so I was interested in what were the conditions that would allow people to get out of this problem.
And then he starts thinking, well, wait, maybe I could use my computer to help me figure out...
what's a good strategy for this?
For something like the Cuban Missile Crisis?
Well, yes, right.
And what made you think that computers could help with that?
Well, I came across a simple game called The Prisoner's Dilemma.
Yeah, wherever you'd like. All right. Yeah, right. Noise from the window.
Okay, so The Prisoner's Dilemma is a very famous thought experiment. It's a little tricky to describe, but I got a friend of mine, Andrew Zolli, who's written about The Prisoner's Dilemma in an upcoming book.
Resilience, the Science of Why Things Bounce Back.
I got him to lay it out for me.
What is The Prisoner's Dilemma?
So imagine that two bank robbers are hanging out across the street from the First National Bank, and the police pick them up. They've received a tip that these two guys are about to rob the bank.
Got it?
Yep.
So the cops take these two guys back to the station, do the whole law and order thing, put them in different rooms.
And they walk into each one. Let's call them Lucky and Joe. And they say to Lucky, we have enough to make sure that you go away for a six-month sentence.
But this is not really what the cops want. They want a longer sentence for one of these guys, mm-hmm. So they make Lucky an offer.
If you, Lucky, rat out Joe, and Joe doesn't say anything, you will go free, and Joe will go to jail for 10 years. If the reverse happens...
meaning if you say nothing and Joe rats you out...
you're going to jail for 10 years, and he's going to walk free.
If you both end up ratting on each other, you both get 5.
5 years.
Whereas if you both keep your mouth shut...
you're each going to jail for 6 months for loitering.
So somehow, if Lucky and Joe could talk to each other, they'd both say, don't speak.
Absolutely. But the big problem that Lucky and Joe have is they can't talk to each other.
All right, so you're Lucky, okay? Mm-hmm. What do you do? Do you rat Joe out or not?
Do I know this guy?
Uh-uh.
At all?
I mean, you met for this one job, but tomorrow you'll never see him again.
Ever.
Ever.
Well, like if I knew him and I could trust him, then I think I know what I would do. But
you'd
if
keep
I don't,
your mouth shut because you didn't get him, 6 months because he'd keep his mouth shut.
It would be a sweet thing.
Indeed.
But, see, since I don't know him, what would happen if he rats me out?
You'd go to jail for 10 years. He'd go free, that bastard.
10 years.
Yeah.
But if I rat him out, then the worst I get is...
5 years.
Or, you know, I go away free. I'm right. Totally free.
Do it, Crowley. I guess say what's in your heart.
I'm throwing him under the bus,
yes,
Jay.
Yes, throw him under.
What's his name again?
Joe.
Joe.
You see he's already gone.
He's already remember him. You're dead to me, Joe.
So you see, in this type of scenario where you don't know the guy, you have a very strong incentive.
To rat the other guy out.
Or as the social scientist would say.
To defect.
That's right. If you play it only once, if you only meet somebody once, whatever the other guy does, you're better off defecting against them.
Just here on out, whenever you hear the word defect, know that it means screw the other guy over.
But the really interesting stuff happens if you play over and over again, if you're going to meet the same people again.
Because now you're thinking, should I help this guy out the next time? If he screwed me, should I screw him?
But this secret, swift, extraordinary buildup of communist missiles.
What do? You want to cooperate, but you don't want to get screwed.
Which cannot be accepted by this country.
Right.
You know, these kind of thoughts were paramount in those days because a prisoner's dilemma was being played between the two superpowers.
This is our friend Steve Strogatz, the Cornell mathematician, who says at that time, all kinds of folks,
political scientists and economists and psychologists, mathematicians,
were writing papers about the prisoner's dilemma.
Literally, and thinking, come on, we've got to be able to win this game if we're going to play against the Russians, and we have to do it right.
Exactly, but there was no consensus on the best way to do it. And so I was interested in what's a good strategy for this?
And that's when Robert Axelrod, sitting down there in the basement somewhere in the Midwest with the big computer, that's when he had his idea.
His approach, which was really novel at the time, was to conduct a computer tournament.
A computer tournament?
Yeah. And invite the people that had come up with these different ideas to play with each other.
In other words, what he said is, all right, Mr. Wise Guy, you know, you've written so and so many articles on the prisoner's dilemma. You think you understand it. How about joining this tournament where you have to submit a program that will play prisoner's dilemma against programs submitted by the other experts? We'll have a round robin.
Right. Try these different programs against each other.
So all these computer guys are brought to Caesar's Palace in Las Vegas, and they all wear tuxedos, and they're all sat down at the table.
No.
It's a nice image, but what really happened was everyone submitted their programs to Axelrod.
They would mail their entries to me. But there was a trophy.
There was a trophy.
I wrote to people, and I said, if you win, I'll send you a trophy. You know, a little plaque that says you won the computer tournament. Yeah.
Okay, so here's the deal. Every program will play every other program 200 times. There will be points in each round, and then Axelrod will total the scores
and see what actually worked.
By which he means, in the long run, even if you lose some rounds here and there, one of these strategies is going to beat all the others, meaning it'll let you survive. Maybe even prosper. That's the game.
That's right.
Can you introduce us to some of the contestants?
Yeah.
So there was one program called Massive Retaliatory Strike.
On the first move, it just cooperates.
But then as soon as the other program doesn't cooperate,
it would then retaliate for the rest of the game.
Like, sorry, man, you blew it.
I'll never trust you again.
Yeah, that's it for you. This is like the way my wife is. Whenever a guy in her earlier life stood her up, that was it.
Game over.
But there were also some trickier programs.
I mean, some crafty ones try to make a model of the opponent.
Like you mentioned one that was called Tester.
So Tester would see what you were like. It would start by being mean. And then if you start retaliating, it backs off and says, you know, ho, chill out. It's okay, man. And, you know, and then starts cooperating for a while until it throws in another.
Just to test the other guy, because after all, it was called Tester.
Yeah, so Tester is kind of designed to see how much it could get away with.
I mean, it sounds kind of sensible in a way. I mean, mean, but...
Well, but if you think about what happens if these two players play each other.
If Tester plays Massive Retaliation 200 times...
Pretty soon the Tester will defect. And then Massive Retaliation will never cooperate again.
Screw you, pal.
Yeah, no,
Yeah, screw you.
Screw you.
Let's go.
Screw me.
You screw
me. You come in here. You come in here. You come close to me.
So, in fact, they'll do very badly, both of them.
When you're sitting there, did you have a hunch as to which would be the most successful program? Or were you?
Well, I didn't know, and which is why I wanted to do it. But I did have a hunch that, you know, thousands or tens of thousands of lines of code would be needed to have a pretty competent program.
So when the mailman delivers the fattest envelope to your house, you're like, this could be the one.
Well, yes, right. Now, it didn't turn out that way.
When it was all said and done, when he loaded all the programs into the computer, when they'd all played each other 200 times, the program that won?
It's really two lines of code.
Two lines of code?
Yeah, it's got a simple name. It's called tit for tat.
First line of code, be
nice.
Nice?
Yeah, nice. Nice is a technical word in this game. Nice means I never am nasty first.
And after that,
second line of code,
it just does what the other player did on the previous move. So if the other player has just cooperated, it'll cooperate. And if the other player has just defected, it'll defect.
It retaliates on the next move. Couldn't be clearer. On the other hand, it only retaliates that one time. I mean, unless provoked further. It does its retaliation, and now bygones are bygones, and that's it.
So wait, how exactly did it win? I mean, can you give us a sense of why it won?
Okay, so let's suppose, here, let's take an extreme case of some very simple programs. One of them I'll call Jesus.
Just for the sake of
a name. Just for the sake of a name. Now, the Jesus program cooperates on every turn. That is, it's always, you know.
Good.
Yes.
So the Jesus program is a simple algorithm that says, always be good.
Good, 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 good.
That's right. And let's say the other program is the Lucifer program, which no matter what, always is bad.
Bad.
Okay. These are your two extremes, says Steve.
And of course, most programs and most people fall somewhere in the middle.
Right.
But in tit for tat, you got a strategy that can swing both ways.
For instance, with Jesus, tit for tat starts by cooperating, as does Jesus.
And then they're going to keep cooperating for the whole 200 rounds.
Which is, you know,
good.
But now let's suppose it plays Lucifer,
where there's no chance to cooperate.
Then, says Steve, tit for tat just plays good defense. So when Lucifer does his thing, tit for tat retaliates. And they pretty much keep doing that and stay even. So in other words,
it's a very robust program. It elicits cooperation if the opponent has any inclination to cooperate, but it doesn't take any guff.
And it wins. So you might say in evolutionary terms, this program
is the fittest.
So actually, Axelrod played an evolutionary version of his tournament. That is, he had these programs after they played their tournament get a chance to reproduce copies of themselves according to how well they did.
You mean the winners would get to have more babies?
Yeah.
And then would the babies play each other?
Yeah, he ran them again. I mean, he ran them for many generations. And so, like, suppose you have a world of Lucifers, and there are a few tit-for-tat players out there. Can they thrive? Can cooperation emerge in this horribly hostile world?
Oh, what an interesting question.
So he looked at that, and the answer was, if you have enough of them so that they have enough chance of meeting each other, they can actually invade and take over the world, even if the world starts horribly mean. I mean, what I take to be the big message, though, I mean, what always sent chills down my spine is that we see this version of morality around the world. You know, be upright, forgiving, but retaliatory. I mean, that sounds to me like the Old Testament.
Huh.
It's not turn the other cheek. It's an eye for an eye. But not 10 eyes for an eye. And to think that it's not something that's handed down by our teachers or by God, but that it's something that came from biology. I like that argument personally.
From biology. Now, do we know whether the math has anything to do with real people in real life situations? Or are we just abstracting behavior? Is this wise or is this just math?
This is what's so impressive to me about Axelrod's work. So he's not just playing math games. He tries to tie this to history and politics as seen
I like to scan journals. One of my, I wouldn't say it's pastime because it's part of my profession, but I came across a book called The Live and Let Live System in World War I.
So here's where we jump away from the math and the computer tournaments and into something very real.
The war began late in July 1914.
That's Stan.
Stanley Weintraub.
Expert in World War I.
Evan Pugh Professor Emeritus at Penn State.
And the story that Stan's going to help us tell takes place on what was called the Western Front, which was basically these two lines of trenches.
Very close to each other, a few hundred yards apart.
And they stretched for hundreds of miles. And that fall...
In November, the weather turned bad. Heavy rains. Then it became icy. And then slush. And then snow. It became disgusting because the trenches also were filled with rats.
Rats.
The rats went after not only the food, but after corpses.
And it was oddly in this miserable, disgusting hellhole that something quite amazing happened. No one quite knows how it started, but one day, maybe around daybreak, let's say, while the two sides were fighting, some of the British soldiers
stopped firing long enough to have breakfast.
And as they were eating, they noticed, the Germans stopped too, to have their breakfast. When they're both done,
they'd begin firing again.
Next morning, same thing. British take their breakfast break at about the same time. The Germans do the same thing. Morning after that, the same thing. And then the next. And after a while...
Both sides caught on that if they didn't interrupt the other one, then they wouldn't be interrupted.
On the whole, there is silence.
This is from a letter a British soldier sent home to his wife at the time.
After all, if you prevent your enemy from drawing his rations, his remedy is simple. He will prevent you from drawing yours.
When Axelrod read this,
I thought, gee, this sounds very familiar.
Line one of Tit for Tat. Be nice first. Now, the Brits probably didn't mean to be nice first when they started the breakfast truce, but it happened, and then the Germans reciprocated, which is line two. Now, keep in mind, these two sides are at war, and implicit in line two is a threat. If you mess with me, I'm going to mess with you.
Well, think about snipers, for example. There's letters where they explain where the snipers would shoot at a tree over and over and over again, showing that, in fact, they were really accurate, meaning that if they wanted to kill you, they'd get you.
And this was going on during the breakfast truce. And these little agreements, you know, like, I'm going to be nice to you, but I could kick your ass, don't forget. Well, these little truces spread all up and down the Western Front until things really changed. Fast forward to December. Christmas Eve.
The climate was just about freezing on Christmas Eve, and the Germans had a tradition of tabletop Christmas trees, small trees.
For weeks, he said, the German government had been
shipping small trees literally to the trenches, hundreds and hundreds of trees.
And that night, on Christmas Eve,
at dusk, the Germans began putting up their trees,
mounted them on the rim of their trench,
and lit candles on them, singing Christmas carols. The British, who might have been no more than 50 or 70 yards away, crawled forward into no man's land to see better.
And then they were spotted. Here's a letter from a German soldier sent home to his family, which describes what happened next.
I shouted to our enemies that we didn't wish to shoot. I said we could speak to each other. At first there was silence.
And then very slowly, out of the darkness, the British guys approached.
And so we came together. And shook hands.
Rob, this is where I start to think, are you making this up? Because this is where it starts to sound sort of crazy to me.
That's Pat Walters, our producer.
It sounds as if this is being made up, and the result was for many decades, people assumed that this was just myth. It couldn't possibly have happened. But we know it had happened because we have the letters that the British and the Germans sent back home. We know that they met in darkness and decided, why don't we have a truce in the morning?
Next morning, thousands of soldiers put down their rifles, climbed out of their trenches into no man's land, and started hanging out with each other.
A lot of us went over and talked to them, and this lasted the whole morning. I talked to several of them, and I must say they seemed extraordinarily fine men.
Soldiers got together, started fires, cooked Christmas dinners.
Swapped. Presents and drank.
The Germans hauled out these enormous
barrels of beer.
They traded stuff.
Cigars and trinkets.
Even helped one another.
Buried the dead.
And in some places on the Western Front, this period of goodwill lasted a whole week.
But then, the generals found out.
They were very angry about this, and they said, if we didn't send you to the front to be nice to the other guys, we sent them to kill them.
If the general says, hey, I want you to shoot those Germans, that's an order.
Well, then they would...
Wouldn't that...
Oh, gee, sorry, General, I missed, but I'll try again better next time.
I see.
The way the generals finally figured out how to disrupt this whole thing is they would said, okay, you guys go out on a raid, and I want you to bring back a prisoner or a corpse.
In other words, show me a scalp. That's an order.
And that messed things up royally.
Here's a letter from a British soldier whose unit contained a band, which was apparently pretty common. He writes this letter about one of the moments when the truce vanished.
At 6 minutes to midnight, the band opened with Die Wacht am Rhein,
which is a German patriotic anthem. So some of the Germans, according to this letter, climbed up onto the rim of their trench to listen to this English band playing their song.
Then, as the last note sounded, every grenade-firing rifle, trench mortar, and bomb-throwing machine let fly simultaneously into the German trench.
So you can imagine the Germans that weren't killed would have felt betrayed. They had just been hanging out with these guys. And the next night, they would have attacked back, and the British would have attacked them back. And then the Germans would have retaliated against them, and on and on and on.
And it would kind of echo back and forth forever.
And that's what happened.
There were immense casualties, as many as 50,000 casualties in a day.
And this, says Axelrod, is where you see sort of the dark side of tit-for-tat.
One of the weaknesses of the tit-for-tat strategy, or one of the problems with it, is these echoes.
Not just echoes of good, obviously, but echoes of violence.
Could get bad. So what I found, though, was that instead of playing pure tit-for-tat, where you always defect if the other guy defects.
There are certain circumstances, he says, and this I find completely fascinating, where you want to modify that second line of code so that you're not always retaliating, you're nearly always retaliating.
Right. If you were a little bit generous, by which I mean, say, 10% of the time you don't defect, then what happens is that these echoes will stop, and I would call that generous tit-for-tat.
So this is kind of interesting. Like, we started with Moses, mm-hmm. You know, eye for an eye. But here it's saying maybe for every 9 parts Moses, you need 1 part Jesus. You know?
Meaning like turn the other cheek.
Turn the other cheek.
It sounds like you've described like a cooking recipe or something.
Well.
Like 9 parts, one
yeah,
thing.
Yeah, I mean, if you abstract it, it's kind of a recipe. It's a recipe for life.
But it isn't a recipe. That ignores the deep fact of it. Look, if I were punching you in the face right now,
mm-hmm.
What are you going to do?
I'm going to punch you back.
Yeah, and I'm going to punch you back. You punch me back, and we're in pain.
Yeah.
And somehow, in the middle of being blasted by my powerful fist, you have to come up with the moral courage to say, I think I'm going to kiss this guy now. And that is not, as you well know, that is not an easy thing to do.
All right, but you're making it all personal. My point is, if you zoom out, this is a strategy that just seems to be woven into the fabric of the cosmos. It works for computers. It works for people. It probably works for amoeba, okay? It just works.
And you think that exists on some higher plane?
I do.
I don't. I think this is still, as you just called it, very personal. I think a person has to choose to be kind.
All right, I'm going to make that choice right now then, okay? Even though you're irritating me, I'm going to say to you, Robert, you look very nice today.
You know what I'm going to do to you?
All right, enough of this. Radiolab.org is our online home. You can read lots of stuff there, and you can subscribe to our podcast.
It's www.
That's implied.
Yeah.
Hi, this is Steve Strogatz. Radiolab is produced by Jad Abumrad and Pat Walters. Our staff includes Soren Wheeler, Ellen Horn, Tim Howard, Brenna Farrell, and Lynn Leiby.
With help from Abby Wendell and Douglas Smith.
Special thanks to Nick Capodice, Graham Parker, Daniel Neumann, and Meg Bowles.
End of mailbox.